Hello, this is Jan Kane, and I'll be reading from the Friday, March 16th edition of the News Gazette, and this is part one. We'll start our reading with our headline story, Alleged Militia Boss Has Made Headlines Before. Until this week, Michael Harry was best known to those outside Ford County for a bizarre child abduction case involving his daughters. It was 2006. 12 years before the Clarence militia leader's arrest on federal charges in connection with a bombing in Minnesota and an attempted bombing in Champaign. Authorities' search led to a Mennonite colony in Belize, where Harry had taken refuge with his kids. He agreed to return to the U.S. with Aline and Molly on one condition, that they appear on the daytime talk show Dr. Phil. Ford County Sheriff's Lieutenant Pat Duffy said authorities, including the U.S. Marshals Service, had tracked Harry to Canada and then to a religious colony in Minnesota. Dr. Phil decided to look and hired a private investigator, Duffy said. That investigator, Harold Kappas, a former FBI special agent, had previously worked with the TV host to find missing children, he said. Kappas met with Ford County officials and then talked with the leader of the religious colony in Minnesota. He said, "You might try looking in Belize," according to Duffy. They located him in a jungle in Belize. They had carved out a religious colony on 2,000 acres in the jungle. Kappas contacted the Belize colony leaders and, with them and Harry, negotiated Harry's return with the girls, Duffy said. Staff from Dr. Phil were in Miami to tape the reunion when the girls were returned to their mother. Harry's punishment, after a jury found him guilty of child abduction, was 30 months probation. This story was written by Will Brumleave. Our next story is from the University of Illinois. The title is Harassment Training Mandate in the Works. It could soon be required in order to sign up for classes. It's written by Julie Wirth. Online training programs about sexual harassment and misconduct may soon become mandatory for University of Illinois students. The university is required by the state and federal government to make the training available, and last year almost 40,000 students took part, about 80% of new students and 40% of returning ones, according to Donna McNeely, Executive Director of the Office of University Ethics. The U of I's online program focuses on promoting greater awareness and prevention of sexual misconduct in both educational and social settings, McNeely said. It supplements other programs offered during the course of the year on each of the three campuses, she told U of I trustees during a presentation Wednesday. But the government doesn't mandate that students complete the training, McNeely said. U of I trustees asked administrators in January why there were no consequences for students who failed to take it. Trustee Jill Smart, a former human resources executive, said Wednesday she had checked with 11 other universities and all imposed some kind of penalty on students who didn't take part. In some cases, freshmen couldn't sign up for classes at orientation until they went through the training, or their accounts were placed on hold for the following semester, she said. U of I President Tim Killeen said the U of I did a larger study of its peer universities and found similar results. Killeen said he is working with the chancellors on the three U of I campuses to make the training mandatory with consequences by next fall. The programs will be tailored to each campus, but Killeen suggested students be prevented from registering for the spring semester if they fail to take the training in the fall. The next class of freshmen coming in would be required to take the training, he said. Smart said later, it's important for students to understand sexual harassment and be aware of it, so they know what to do if they see it, for their own safety and others. Making the training mandatory is really a statement about the importance of it. U of I employees are already required to complete annual training on sexual harassment and misconduct and are subject to disciplinary action if they don't, McNeely said. Last year, more than 40,000 faculty members, staff, graduate employees, and resident advisors completed the program, a 99.88% compliance rate. The training focuses on the university's expectations for employees and outlines how they should respond to and report instances of sexual misconduct, she said. McNeely's office also works closely with administrators on each campus responsible for reporting sexual harassment or misconduct under other state and federal requirements. Both the state of Illinois and the NCAA recently imposed new requirements on sexual misconduct training and reporting, she said. Under the Illinois Preventing Sexual Violence in Higher Education Act, each Illinois university must submit annual reports to the state attorney general and Illinois Department of Human Rights. The first one was due in November of 2017. And a new NCAA policy requires that the chancellor, athletic director, and Title IX coordinator on each campus must attest annually that coaches, athletic administrators, and athletes are educated about sexual violence prevention. The first certification is due in May. Sexual misconduct prevention and response continues to be a major focus area for our compliance efforts, McNeely said. Our next article is also about the University of Illinois. It pertains to the Board of Trustees meeting and is also written by Julie Wirth. The headline is, Criminal Query Discourages College Applicants. A movement to, quote, ban the box, asking about prior criminal history on job applications, has spawned a similar effort in college admissions. A student-led group urged University of Illinois trustees on Thursday to drop questions about students' criminal and disciplinary history from the admissions applications at all three U of I campuses. Amber Blatt, a graduate student in social work at the UI Chicago, said admissions policies can create barriers to education. The U of I requires applicants to describe their criminal records and high school disciplinary violations, which can be invasive and humiliating and discourage students from applying, Blatt said, addressing the board during its public comments session. It sends the message that such students are not welcome to apply here, she said. Supporters from the group Yes Apply at Illinois held up signs reading, All students welcome to apply, which they said were modeled after 19th century Irish need not apply signs. National surveys show that 60 to 80% of private institutions and 55% of public institutions require undergraduate applicants to answer criminal history questions as part of the admissions process, according to a report from the Brookings Institution. The overriding reason is to protect campus safety. The information they ask for is often much broader than what employers typically request on job applications, the report said. Employers usually limit their questions to convictions rather than arrests, and often to felonies or crimes within a specific time frame. But it's common for universities to ask about any type of conviction, including misdemeanors and juvenile records, with no time limitation, the report said. Many schools also ask about high school disciplinary violations. The U of I's Urbana campus asks students whether they've ever had to leave a school for academic reasons, whether they've been subject to disciplinary action at school, or whether they've been convicted of a crime or have pending criminal charges, says Director of Admissions Andy Borst. If students respond with a yes to any of those questions, a drop-down box appears asking them to provide additional information about the reasons or circumstances, any corrective action imposed, and their current status, among other details. But applicants are not automatically disqualified if they mark yes, he said, and the information is not passed along to academic reviewers in the colleges. The reviewers can't see the answers to those questions, he said. If students are recommended for admission following that review, the information is passed along to the Dean of Students' Office and the applicant goes through a detailed committee review, he said. After an investigation, that office reports back to Borst with a decision to deny or admit the student, he said. Of the nearly 40,000 U of I applicants, 100 to 200 students each year mark yes to one or more of those questions, 0.5% or less, he said. Of those, 10 to 15 cases go through a committee review, and only a handful are denied admission for those reasons, he said. Blatt said the group is concerned about discouraging applicants in the first place. The questions have a chilling effect, she said. She talked about a friend who was caught with marijuana when she was 19. When the woman later applied to the U of I's education program, She stopped at the questions about criminal history. She assumed the school didn't want to train teachers with records, Blatt said, and was too ashamed to ask further questions. There's too many people not at this school because they saw the question and did not apply, she said. Blatt said the policy disproportionately affects people from poor communities and underrepresented groups who are more likely to have disciplinary or conviction records. Some high schools have extremely high rates of suspensions and expulsions compared to others, she said. The Brookings report cited studies showing about 30% of Americans have been arrested at least once by the age of 23, with arrest rates particularly high among young men of color, 44% of Hispanic men and 49% of Black men, compared to 38% of white men. The report also said there's no evidence showing the screening questions actually prevent crime on campuses, though few studies have been done. Blatt said people with criminal records already face barriers in housing and employment and shouldn't be discouraged from furthering their education, which helps reduce recidivism and improve safety, she said. In 2016, under the Obama administration, the U.S. Department of Education offered guidance to help colleges reduce barriers for applicants with criminal histories, such as banning the box or delaying collecting the information until an admissions decision is made. The UI Chicago has removed the question from its applications for graduate school, Blatt said. Last June, Louisiana became the first state to ban all public colleges from asking about criminal history during the application process, with exceptions for convictions relating to sexual assault or stalking. The State University of New York's board also voted to stop asking applicants about felony convictions. California state schools have never asked the question, Blatt said. A bill introduced last spring in the Illinois House would prevent public colleges from asking about criminal history at any time during the admissions decision-making process, unless required to by federal or state law. Colleges could ask about it after an applicant is admitted, but could not rescind an offer based on the information. Illinois should abolish these questions, and we should lead the way in the Midwest, Blatt said. Our next article pertains to Election 2018, and the byline is Tom Kasich. The headline is Early Votes Up Notably. Democratic primary accounts for most of the ballots cast so far. More than twice the number of pre-election day votes have been cast in Champaign County this year as in a comparable election 4 years ago, and there are still 4 days of early voting to go. County Clerk Gordy Hulton said Thursday night that 6,415 early or mail-in votes had been tabulated through the close of voting Thursday, more than twice the 3,178 votes recorded before Election Day in the March 2014 primary. And the number of voters taking Democratic ballots in Champaign County is up markedly. 4 years ago, there were 23,299 votes cast in the county in the primary election. 63% of them, or 14,683, were Republican. But so far this year, 63% of the ballots chosen by voters, 4,046, are Democratic. In fact, the number of Democratic ballots cast so far in the county is almost half the total in the entire 2014 primary election. It's unknown, though, whether the unusual number of Democratic ballots selected is an indication of a Democratic wave in the county this spring, or just a matter of timing, because University of Illinois students and Champaign and Urbana schools will be on spring break next week. Champaign and Urbana generally vote more Democratic than the rest of the county. Voting by Democrats is strong at the campus voting center at Illini Union, where the partisan margin is 634 to 55, Democratic. But Republican ballots are favored at early voting centers in Mahomet, 147 to 91, and in Southwest Champaign at the Meadowbrook Community Center, 274 to 245. Early voting will continue in Champaign County through the weekend and on Monday. Voting hours at all 8 satellite voting centers are 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. today, 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. Saturday, and 1 to 4 p.m. Sunday. Monday's hours are 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Voting hours at the County Clerk's Office at the Brookins Center in Urbana are 8 a.m. to 7 p.m. today, 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. Saturday and Sunday, and 8 a.m. to 7 p.m. Monday. Our next story is entitled Vigil Held for Shooting Victim. It's written by Tim Mitchell. About 100 people turned out Thursday night on a North Champaign street to pay tribute to a man who was killed in a shooting there earlier this week. Participants prayed, lit candles, and sent hundreds of balloons into the air in the 700 block of North Hickory Street to honor Montrez Vonner, age 34, of Champaign. Mr. Vonner died just before 2 a.m. Sunday at Carle Foundation Hospital in Urbana, a victim of multiple gunshot wounds. Mr. Vonner's brother, Galen Allen Davis, said it was important to honor him at the location where he was shot. "A lot of family and friends came out today," Allen Davis said. "He was a good guy. He loved his kids, and he stayed out of trouble." Our next story is A Life Remembered, written by Tracy Crane, and it pertains to Emily Watts, a U of I English professor and author who was recalled for her brilliance. An award-winning author and U of I English professor for nearly three decades, Emily Watts could have easily carved out a career in math as well. In the 1950s, when Emily Ann Stipes Watts was a student at Central High School and the space race was just beginning, she and only one other Central student qualified for a program recruiting the brightest of young math minds. But the male student was chosen, said Ed Watts, the middle son of Mrs. Watts. That young man, Harold Edwards, went on to become a well-known mathematician, earning his doctorate from Harvard. But fortunately for the U of I, Mrs. Watts eventually became a full professor of English, which was her calling, according to her son, a professor at Michigan State University. "She was a good scholar, a great teacher," he said, adding that he has received so many emails and messages from former students of Mrs. Watts, age 81, since her passing on Monday in Urbana. He said his mother was very demanding but thoughtful of her students. "She was what a professor was supposed to be in every way, really," he said, explaining that she loved literature from the start, majored in the classics, and became an expert on Ernest Hemingway. A 1954 Central High graduate, Mrs. Watts earned her bachelor's degree at the U of I in 1958, then master's in 1959 as a Woodrow Wilson National Fellow, and finished up with her doctorate in 1963. As a John Simon Guggenheim Memorial Foundation Fellow in 1973-74, she completed her first book, Ernest Hemingway and the Arts, which won the Modern Language Association's Scholars Library Award. Jim Vermette, CEO of the University of Illinois Alumni Association from 1967 to 1983, said Mrs. Watts was a brilliant person, straightforward, fair, and an excellent writer. "It's a real loss," he said of Mrs. Watts, who would have celebrated her 82nd birthday on Friday. "But a life well lived, that's for sure." Vermette said she was one of the smartest people he ever knew, explaining that while she was president of the U of I Faculty Senate, she was a conservative in a more liberal environment. But she was effective because she was so fair and so smart. She had a profound effect on the university long term, he said. Besides teaching, Mrs. Watts's profound effect also included creating more opportunities for women on campus, especially in athletics. She was the chairwoman of the U of I Athletic Board and was a member of the task force that brought women athletes into the Big Ten. Former U of I Athletic Director Ron Gunther first got to know her when she was a U of I student, and Mrs. Watts was a tutor for athletes, including U of I football legend Dick Butkus. Gunther said he recently reached out to Butkus to let him know Mrs. Watts wasn't doing well. Butkus told him that he was very fond of her and that she was very helpful to him as an undergraduate. In the 1970s, Gunther said the U of I started women's sports, and she was very helpful in that mission as part of the athletic board. "She was a very big advocate of Title IX and women's sports," he said, explaining that she and her husband, the late Robert Watts, attended a lot of U of I athletic events for men and women, and she was also a strong supporter of expanding the academic support system for athletes. She was very direct and very supportive. She was a terrific liaison between the academic department and the athletic department. Lou Lier, former UI Alumni Association director, knew her for more than 30 years. She was a big mover for women's sports. She was a very important part of the growth of women's sports at the U of I, he said. I always admired her for that. She was very strong-willed. Ed Watts said his mom followed Illinois sports her whole life and attended U of I basketball games when they were at Huff Hall. He said she even took on a national role in regard to academic issues in athletics. Though she favored academic stringency, he said, she was not a fan of standardized tests in general and did not support linking those test scores to eligibility in athletics, a position shared by former Georgetown University men's basketball coach John Thompson. They spoke together at various events on the issue, Ed Watts said, recalling the humor in seeing them together, because his mother was 5 feet 4 inches tall and Thompson's about 6 foot 10 inches. She led her life always on her own terms, he said. Outside academic life, Ed Watts said, his mother was very devoted to her family, too, which included her husband and 3 sons. In the summers, they spent time in Michigan, where their father's ancestral roots were, which gave his mother more opportunities to pursue her love of riding horses and sailing. She still has a horse, Ed Watts said, adding that she was still riding until a year ago and working on another Hemingway book. He said she was an animal lover and they always had plenty of dogs, hamsters, and all sorts of critters, and she enjoyed watching deer in the woods, too. Lier said she loved animals and she had a dog named True Love, a collie that lived to about 12 years old, passing away last year. He said the dog followed her everywhere. She would walk it every day, said Lier, whose wife often rode horses with Mrs. Watts. She was a wonderful woman. We just always loved being with her. Our next article is entitled, State's Unemployment Rate Continues to Drop. The unemployment rate continued to drop in January compared to a year ago, both in the Champaign-Urbana and Danville metro areas. Champaign-Urbana's unemployment rate dropped from 5.5% a year ago to 4.2% in January, and Danville's dropped from 7.8% a year ago to 6% in January, according to numbers released Thursday by the Illinois Department of Employment Security. Across Illinois, the unemployment rate dropped from 6.1% a year ago to 5.3% in January, while 41,000 jobs were added statewide. In the Champaign-Urbana metro area, 1,400 jobs were added over the year. Government added 1,000 jobs, education and health services added 600, leisure and hospitality added 200, professional and business services added 200, durable goods manufacturing added 100, transportation, warehousing, and utilities added 100, information added 100, and financial activities added 100. Meanwhile, retail trade lost 700 jobs, manufacturing of non-durable goods lost 100, and wholesale trade lost 100. In the Danville metro area, 400 jobs were lost over the year. This article was written by Ben Zeiderman. Our next story is about the Philo Village Board. The headline is Boutique Gambling Parlor Proposed. The Philo Village Board will take public comment at its April 11th meeting and is planning to vote at its May 9th meeting on an Urbana business owner's proposal to relocate her clothing boutique to Philo on one condition. She would like to have a gambling parlor above it. Bailey's Boutique owner, Tara Block, told the Village Board that she would like to buy the VersaBar building at 101 East Washington Street and open a women's and children's clothing boutique on the first floor and to have 5 gambling machines on the second floor. It will help us survive and grow on the first floor. I know that will cover my mortgage, she said. We know it'll bring more business to the area. It will bring more jobs in. I think it could be an amazing thing. In order to have the video gambling terminals under state law, Block would need to apply for a Class P liquor license, which would allow her to sell beer and wine in the gambling parlor. I don't want to have a bar or to be a bar, she said. Block said she likes the historic character of the downtown brick building that is believed to have been built in the late 1800s at the corner of Washington and Harrison Streets. Her family lives in Philo, and she said part of the reason she wants her business there is that so she can spend more time with her children. She said she intended to keep the two businesses separate, with the front entrance being for the clothing boutique and the back entrance being for the gambling parlor. It's not an easy sell in the community as far as another business that sells alcohol, Village President Larry Franks warned Block. I really don't want Philo to be a gaming capital. Trustee Steve Sappenfield noted that the town already has three businesses with gaming machines. Two of them are doing fine, and one is not doing much, he said. I see nothing wrong with it, Trustee John Mumma said. Do you really want to get into picking and choosing like that? Our next story is from Monticello, from their school district. The headline is Second Bogus Threat in 10 Days. Monticello school officials investigated a threat made to the high school this week, the second to a district building in the past 10 days. After investigating, school officials and Monticello police deemed the latest threat to be not credible. In a message sent to parents, Monticello Superintendent Vic Zimmerman said, on Wednesday afternoon, March 14th, the Monticello Middle School principal received a report from two MMS students that another MMS student had stated that they wanted to shoot up the high school. After further investigation with the Monticello Police Department and Middle School Administration, the Monticello Police Department determined that the statement had been made, but that it was not a credible threat. The student is facing disciplinary consequences for making the statement and will not be attending school at this time, he continued. Students are reminded that making comments such as these in school is not appropriate, and doing so will cause major disciplinary action, including possible suspension or expulsion from school. All potential threats or statements of this type are taken seriously and investigated, whether they are large or small, direct or indirect, or intentional, or made as a joke. School officials investigated a separate incident on March 4th after the Monticello High School principal received word of a rumor that a MHS student had discussed bringing a gun to school the following day. That threat was also deemed not credible. It is the fourth threat investigated by Piatt County Schools over the past month, the other two being on February 16th in Cerro Gordo and at Blue Ridge Intermediate and Junior High School in Mansfield on February 20th. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half of the Friday, March 16th reading of the News Gazette. Please stay tuned.